Exodus chapter 21, verses 1 to 21. The 23rd talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on March 12, 2017 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 21, Exodus 21, verses 1 to 27, accompanies this talk.
We'll be looking at chapter 21 of Exodus. Just to remind you the setting in which this is occurring, God has brought the Israelites out of Egypt through the wilderness, and he has brought them to Mount Sinai, where he said that he would meet them. And for 3 days, they were to purify themselves and prepare themselves to meet with God. Then, at the appointed time, God showed up. There was thunder and lightning and fire and earthquake. And God spoke to the people of Israel and gave them the Ten Commandments, which was, for the Israelites, a frightening experience. I think it would be a frightening experience for any of us. And so that they requested that God not give them the rest of the terms of the agreement. That's what's being offered here, an agreement that God is making with the people of Israel. God will give the rest of the terms of the agreement to Moses, and Moses will pass it on to them. That's less scary. And God consents to that arrangement. And so now Moses has gone up into the cloud for God to present to him the rest of the terms of the agreement. So this is these are the laws that he's going to give to Moses, who will then pass them on to the Israelites. So we'll be starting into that at the beginning of chapter 21. But first I want to talk just a little bit about the nature of these laws and the nature of laws in general in the ancient Near East. Then I want to talk about just a little bit about the organization of these laws within the next three chapters. And then we'll jump into the first section. This part of Exodus is often referred to as the Covenant Code or the Book of the Covenant. Those two terms are both used. And that comes from some wording in chapter 24, at the end of verse 3, verse 4. And Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. Then skip down to verse 7. Then he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people. And they said, all that the Lord has spoken we will do, etc. So the book of the covenant, that is a term that apparently refers to the words that he wrote down in verse 4, which is these three chapters. So that's where the term the Code of the Covenant comes from. Some people think that the whole section, including the Ten Commandments and these laws that we'll get into today, all of that is the Covenant Code. Others reserve that term for just the commandments that start in chapter 21 and continue through chapter 23. I've talked before about the law codes that have been found in the ancient Near East. There have been a lot of them found. And there have been studies done to compare those law codes with the laws that we have in the Old Testament. And I will be referring to some of the laws of the ancient Near East and by comparison with what we run into here in Exodus. The best example of a law code, the best known example, and one of the earliest and most complete law codes that we have from the ancient Near East is the Code of Hammurabi. The Code of Hammurabi was written, they think, in about 1750 BC. It's Babylonian in origin. Hammurabi was the king of Babylon. And interestingly, we have pieces, we have one large copy of it, and that's in the Louvre in Paris. It's a large stele that's I think it's about 7 or 8 feet tall, and it has the code engraved on the sides of this stone pillar. But we also have parts of it that have been found on tablets elsewhere, some of those dating to much later, several hundred years later. And I will just point out now, this will be significant for when we talk about the laws in Exodus, that over those hundreds of years, the content of Hammurabi's code changed very little. Even the fines stayed the same, in spite of known periods of time when there was inflation. So it's very little changed over that period of time. So it's not like our laws that get adjusted quite frequently. Those stayed the same over hundreds of years. The other thing that's interesting is the order in which the laws occur often varies from one version of the code to another. So the order was not sacrosanct. They felt free to change the order. They not only felt free to change the order, they also felt free to change the wording. The way that it was actually worded in the code, it would change from one to another, sometimes significantly, but the meaning or the content of the law rarely changed. So the wording changes, they aren't particular about keeping the wording the same, but the content is held static over a long period of time. Okay, so as we go through these laws, I will frequently refer to the Code of Hammurabi because that's one of the best points of reference, but please keep in mind that there are other law codes that were out there. There are quite a few that have survived to our time. Just some general comments about how they're the same and how they're different, the other law codes, compared to those in the Bible. They are different in these respects. One is the other law codes are from the king to his people, as opposed to the law code that we have in the Pentateuch, which is from God to the people. So it's directly from God without any intermediary in the Bible. Secondly, we will see that there are many similar laws between what we find in the Bible and in the ancient Near Eastern law codes, but the tendency is for the laws in the Bible to be a little more humane on the one hand, and on the other hand, some things the Bible is more strict on. So more humane in some ways and stricter in other ways. The third, the laws in the Bible frequently don't have a penalty. That's unusual. You don't see that in the other law codes. The other law codes, it'll say, if this happens, then this is the penalty. That's frequently true in the Old Testament as well, but there are quite a few laws that don't have a penalty that is listed. And the fourth difference is there are occasionally explanations given for the laws in the Old Testament, whereas in the other law codes, you don't have explanations for the laws. Now, how are they similar? And this in my studies was what was surprising to me, actually. One is that these law codes are quite incomplete. That is to say, that if you wanted to know what you can do and what you can't do, and have it legal, you would be hard-pressed to figure that out from the law code alone. The law codes just cover certain scenarios. But there are lots of things that aren't addressed by the law codes at all. And it is believed by scholars that there must have been a common understanding of what the basic laws were and what the penalties should be for violations of those laws. And that common understanding was passed down through the culture such that everybody in those cultures knew what is permissible and what is not permissible and what would be the penalty for violating those principles. Then, secondly, the law codes then that we see in the ancient Near East are just case law. That is to say, they cover certain specific scenarios that can be used as some kind of guideline to figure out what ought to be the judgment in any particular case. And these case laws are covering areas of the law that are in some kind of question, where the commonly held cultural code is a little bit vague, or it needs to be corrected a little bit. That seems to be the nature of the ancient Near Eastern law codes. So they are case law, where we have what it was a wise judgment in a given situation. And so it's a record of those wise judgments in various situations. It is interesting that we have, the scholars have, they have law codes that have survived down to our time. There are also court judgments that have been recorded and have survived down to our time. But some interesting things about those court judgments is, first of all, there has never been one found that refers to a law code. So you never have a situation where it says, I, the judge, decide X in this case because of this particular law in a law code. That doesn't happen. The second thing that is interesting is, in a few cases, there are specific judgments that are made that are contrary to the law code of the time that we have. So the judges felt free, to one degree or another, to deviate from what the law code said, which is interesting. And it calls into question exactly how they thought about these law codes, and scholars debate that. What kind of a thing is this, and how was it used? The fourth thing is, there is the order in which the laws are presented is not always clear. That is, it's not, the organization is not always clear. You can have a case in which it's dealing with some kind of theft, and you can have the next one, a case that deals with something very different from that. This is consistent through all the law codes of the ancient Near East. And as one of the authors pointed out that I thought was very helpful, he said, you have to understand that the ancient Near East was a culture of lists. They have lots of lists. In fact, when scribes were learning how to read and write, their exercises were to copy lists. Lists of terms, lists of animals, lists of cities, lists of all kinds. And in a culture in which you're used to lots of lists, there isn't necessarily going to be a need for order within those lists. It's just a list of a group of things that share something in common. I was, a few years ago, I was thinking about this, and I reflected on one of my experiences a few years ago. I was questioning whether my memory was working right. I was thinking that it wasn't working right. I still think I'm right. But the doctor was examining me, and she asked me to list all of the animals that I could, and she said, in 2 minutes. So I had 2 minutes to list as many animals as I could think of. And so I started, okay, what kind of animals are on a farm? And I listed animals on a farm. And then I got to sheep, and I thought, oh, let's do mammals. How many mammals can I think of? And I started off on mammals. And I got to a tiger, and I thought, well, let's do animals in Africa. So I listed all the animals in Africa I could think of. And I got to an ostrich. And I thought, well, let's do birds. And so I did, et cetera. And I spent the 2 minutes just going like that, jumping from the one thing to another, triggered by some animal that I had just named. And as best I understand it, that is the most common kind of organization in these law codes. It's a list. They tend to come in groups for a particular scenario, kind of scenario, but then it'll jump to something else. And Umberto Casuto, one of the authors that I looked at, he says typically you'll see it organized according to analogy and association. And as I understand it, that's what he's talking about what I was just describing when I named the animals. And we'll see one of those instances in this passage. Otherwise, this particular passage is pretty well organized. It's better organized than most of the ancient Near Eastern laws. And we'll see what that organization is. Noam Sarna describes the organization in the next three chapters as follows. He says, "We must begin our inquiry with a rather prosaic comment that all the mishpatim," so the mishpatim are the first group of laws in this section, "the rules and the provisions of the legislation contained within the first section of the Book of the Covenant, Exodus 21:2 to 22:16, fall within the scope of the coercive power of the state and come within the jurisdiction of the law courts. The second part of the collection, however, is quite different. Exodus 21:17 through 23:19 consists of a miscellany of social, ethical, moral, and religious prescriptions that are predominantly couched in the concise, apodictic style of the Ten Commandments with their magisterial, authoritative tone. They come under the rubric of Devarim, the commands, mentioned in Exodus 24:3, and they constitute normative standards for controlling human conduct, standards imposed by a transcendent divine will. Apart from the first three prohibitions outlying sorcery, bestiality, and sacrificing to other gods, their enforcement is left to the individual conscience, not to political institutions." So the first part is what we think of as laws. If someone does X, then this penalty follows. And he says it falls under the scope of the coercive power of the state. The second part, which is actually longer, consists of, he uses the term devarim, or commands, for them. But those are things that you ought not do, but it's left to one's individual conscience to guide you. There are no penalties given. The power of the state doesn't come to bear with respect to those issues. So, in the first part, then, it's issues of major harm, where the punishments are listed. The second part, lesser offenses, where no punishments are given. And the third section is going to be warnings against assimilating in with the culture of the surrounding peoples when they enter into the land. Now, within the first part then, the Mishpatim, there is further organization. It's going to start out with laws concerning slavery. Then it's going to move on to murder and other serious crime. Then it will move on to non-fatal personal injury, first by humans and then second by animals. Then it's going to move on to injury to livestock. And then lastly, it's going to be theft and negligence. So that's the order of the commandments in this first part, or the Mishpatim in this first part of the three chapters. Okay, I'll read the first section, verses 1 through 11 of chapter 21 in Exodus. Now these are the ordinances which you are to set before them. If you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve for 6 years, but on the seventh he shall go out as a free man without payment. If he comes alone, he shall go out alone. If he is the husband of a wife, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master gives him a wife, and she bears him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall belong to her master, and he shall go out alone. But if the slave plainly says, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out as a free man, then his master shall bring him to God. Then he shall bring him to the door or the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall serve him permanently. If a man sells his daughter as a female slave, she is not to go free as the male slaves do. If she is displeasing in the eyes of her master, who designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He does not have authority to sell her to a foreign people because of his unfairness to her. And if he designates her for his son, he shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. If he takes to himself another woman, he may not reduce her food, her clothing, or her conjugal rights. And if he will not do these three things for her, then she shall go out for nothing without payment of money. Now there's much in here that is mysterious, but there is cultural background that really helps to make some of these things clearer, much clearer. First thing is, why would this topic be the first topic of the laws that are being presented to the people of Israel? Why would slavery be the first thing? We will talk about that more at the end. The term that is used for slave in this passage is eved ivri. The term eved means slave or servant. Ivri means Hebrew. And some people take this to mean an Israelite slave. That is, an Israelite who has become a slave of another Israelite. Umberto Casuto doesn't think that that is the best explanation. He thinks that this term is an old term. And the reason that it is Ivri or Hebrew is because that, if you'll recall, when the Israelites were in Egypt, whenever the Egyptians talk about them, they talk about them using the term Hebrew, that they are Hebrews. And that term Hebrew was a term that referred to a broader group of people than just the descendants of Abraham. It refers to a social class of people that were typically slaves. So either mercenary soldiers or slaves or something of that nature. If that's true, then what's being talked about here is not necessarily an Israelite slave, but rather it's just talking about slaves and people of that slave, of that social category. So it could be that foreigners would be included in this command. So if Kasuto is right, then this is broader than just Israelites who are serving as slaves. He says, but the actual sense of the verse in this paragraph, which is undoubtedly very old, corresponds to the conditions of life obtaining in early times and uses the expression Hebrew slave in its primary signification, which included not only Israelite slaves, but a wider category of bondmen. Then the word slave can be a much broader term than we think of when we think of a slave. We think of a slave in terms of American history, someone who is bought and sold and is with the master for life unless something unusual happens. In ancient Israel, it has a much broader meaning. There's several things that all fall under the category of slave. One would be a foreigner who is taken captive in war. A foreigner taken captive in war is a slave, can be held as a slave, kept as a slave, and it's debatable whether they can be held as a slave for the rest of their life or whether it can only be a 7-year period. And we won't get into that, but that it's either one is possible. We don't know for sure. The second meaning is an Israelite slave, and an Israelite slave is an Israelite who sells himself into slavery to another Israelite, serves that person for 7 years, and then at the end of the 7 years is released. And there can be a variety of reasons why someone might choose to sell themselves into slavery. The third is just a contract worker. If an Israelite hires someone to do a job, a particular job, says, I'll pay you X number of dollars to do this particular task, then you can use the term slave to refer to that contract labor. And they use that term. The fourth meaning is a concubine. So a woman who is taken as a concubine by a man is categorized as a slave, and that term can be used for that woman. So it's quite a broad range of meanings that can be used for the term the term slave. It is often said that the institution of slavery in Israel was not the brutal institution that we're familiar with. It was not as brutal. First of all, it was not driven by economic factors the way that slavery in the United States was. That is to say, there were crops that were being raised in the United States for which cheap labor was critical. And that was the impetus for at least the expansion of slavery in America. But there isn't that kind of same kind of economic motivation driving slavery in ancient Israel. Secondly, there were important and constraints that were placed on the master of a slave, what they could do and what they couldn't do with the slave. And some of those measures, slaves were required to be treated the same way as anyone else. So, for instance, Sabbath. Slaves had to be allowed to keep the Sabbath along with everybody else. The festivals. Slaves had to be allowed to keep the festivals along with everybody else, etc. And the third thing to note about ancient slavery in Israel is that slavery was the ancient world's equivalent to bankruptcy. That if someone became absolutely destitute, there was a way out, and that way out was to sell yourself into slavery, and that would be for 7 years, but after the end of 7 years, you're out of your debt situation. I'll just as a side note here, I watched a program about bankruptcy in America a few years ago that I found fascinating. They were just talking about, gave instances and interviewed people who had gone through bankruptcy, how they got to the place where they decided to file for bankruptcy, and what happened when they filed, and then what happened afterwards, whether they got back on their feet or not. And the vast majority recovered financially after they had filed for bankruptcy and resolved all of their debt situation. They got back on their feet financially and did fairly well. And they pointed out in this show that in those societies that have something like a bankruptcy provision, the economy is more vibrant because people are willing to take some chances because they know that if they fail, it may be miserable, it may be difficult, but there is a way out. You aren't going to end up in debtor's prison for the rest of your life. In those societies where there is no mercy for those who get into financial difficulty, people don't take risks at all. They're very, very conservative. And as a result, the economy is less vibrant. I thought that was very interesting. And by the way, Nashville is the bankruptcy capital of the United States for reasons that I don't know. But. So slavery was their version of the escape route if you run into dire straits financially. And as a result, anyone could end up a slave. There's a sense in which there, people understood anybody could end up as a slave. As a result, the institution as a whole was a little more benign than it might otherwise have been. Okay, so now to the passage. What is this saying? First point here is after a Hebrew slave has served the 6 years, he's allowed to go without any further payment. In fact, as you go later on in the law in Deuteronomy, the master is actually responsible to help get that slave, that former slave, on his feet financially. He has to be provided with enough wherewithal that he can get started financially. So he goes after 7 years. He serves for 6 years, and then on the seventh year he goes free. Now the question is, how does he go? And there are three scenarios. What if he becomes a slave and he's unmarried, he's single? If that is the case, then when he goes, he leaves single. What if he is married when he comes as a slave? If that is the case, then when he leaves, his wife goes with him. She also is freed. The third scenario is, what if he comes single and is married while he is a slave? Now, it was apparently common practice in ancient Israel for the masters of slaves to marry single Israelite slaves to single foreign slaves that are in their possession. And then any children that come from that marriage are the slaves of the master. So it was to the benefit of the master then to have his slaves have children. So what it's saying with respect to that particular practice is if that happens, then the slave, after the end of 6 years, the man, he goes free. But his wife, the woman, and the children, they stay in the possession of the master. Unless the slave man decides, I would rather stay as a slave and keep my wife and my children. If he decides that he would rather have that, then there is a formal procedure that they go through in which he can that arrangement can be made. And the formal arrangement requires for him to go, it says, to go, he shall bring him to God. And that typically means take him to the tabernacle or take him to the temple. And at the tabernacle, then, his earlobe would be pierced against the doorpost of the tabernacle. So an awl would be stuck through the ear. And so there would be a permanent mark there that's left, indicating that this arrangement has been made. So it's public, and both the slave and the master know what the arrangement is. And they're making this arrangement before the priests at the tabernacle. If that's the case, then he stays with the master. He and his family stay with the master for the rest of his life. The last part of this is dealing with women who become slaves. And again, background information is helpful. It was common for poor families to sell their daughters into slavery to someone who has more means. The family would benefit two ways. They get some money from the sale of the daughter. And secondly, they wouldn't have the expense of having to raise that daughter. That expense would become the master's obligation. Generally speaking, that sale had to occur before the girl was 12 years old. And the girl had to consent to the arrangement before it could be done. In those cases, I don't know if this is always the case or if it's generally the case, but that girl then was destined to become either the daughter of the master, a concubine of the master, or a concubine of the master's son. Those are the two most common scenarios. Okay, so in our passage then, it says, if a man sells his daughter as a female slave, she is not to go free as the male slaves do. So it's a different kind of arrangement. She is a different kind of slave. She is destined to be a concubine. If she is displeasing in the eyes of her master who designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He does not have authority to sell her to a foreign people because of his unfairness to her. So if he decides he doesn't want to marry her, then he has to allow for her to leave, to be redeemed, and then she could go free. But in any case, he can't sell her to a foreigner. She's an Israelite and must remain within Israel. And if he designates her for his son, he shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. In other words, if she is destined to be the wife of his son, then he needs to treat her as any daughter-in-law would be treated in Israel. If he takes to himself another woman, he may not reduce her food, her clothing, or her conjugal rights. So if she is destined to be his concubine, he takes another woman as his wife, then she has to be maintained the way that she was maintained before he takes the wife. He has to provide her with food, clothing. And then it says her conjugal rights. This is how this should be translated is not clear. The rabbis took this to be conjugal rights. They translated it that way, but they're dealing with this text at a much later date. It's possible that this just means a place to live, shelter. But I don't know which it is. In any case, she needs to be well-maintained if he chooses another woman to be his wife. And if he will not do these three things for her, then she shall go out for nothing without payment of money. And again, it's not clear what these three things are, but I think Casuto's offering on this particular verse is probably the best. The three things being her food, her clothing, and her either conjugal rights or her shelter. So if he doesn't take care of her, then she needs to be released without payment of money. So those are the things that God has to say with respect to slavery, that are adjustments to the common code. The next section, verse 12, he who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. But if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, then I will appoint you a place to which he may flee. If, however, a man acts presumptuously towards his neighbor, so as to kill him craftily, you are to take him even from my altar, that he may die. So here we have a distinction being made on the basis of intent. Was there intent to kill, or was there not intent to kill? If there was not intent to kill, then there is a place to which he can flee and be safe. And those become, later on, those become the cities of refuge that are established in the land when they go into the land. If it was intentional, then the penalty is death. He will be put to death. And even if he goes to the temple and lays his hand on the horns of the temple, of the altar, so the corner of the, there are four corners on the altar, lays his hand on the corner of the altar, which was considered to be a place of sanctuary. And this is true throughout the culture. In fact, you run into it in the Iliad. In the Iliad, if you recall, the Trojans, when they've been defeated, go running to the altar, lay their hand on the corner of the altar, expecting to be spared because of that. And the Greeks come in and kill them anyway, and then the gods get vengeance on the Greeks because of that. So it's a common understanding throughout the ancient world. And what God is saying is, even if such a person lays hand to the corner of the altar, he'll be taken and punished with the death penalty. Understand that the situation that's being described, the context here in which this is being spoken, is one in which the cultures of the ancient world are coming out of, slowly coming out of, a situation in which every tribe got its own justice with respect to members of its tribe that have been wronged. So if someone kills a member of my tribe has the obligation of getting vengeance. And the logic behind it is, there is no system of justice that can be trusted here. It's every tribe for itself. And therefore, every tribe has to be diligent to get vengeance for wrongs done to it, so that nobody will come along and mess with us again. People will be very hesitant to mess with us. So that's the logic behind the code of vengeance. And to one degree or another, that was a part of the culture in which God is speaking here. And the goal of these law codes is to get the tribes to have faith in the justice system so that they will relax in trying to get vengeance. Because obviously the problem with a vengeance system is, if somebody kills a member of my tribe, I have to get vengeance. I'm going to go kill a member of that tribe. And what are they going to do? They're going to come back and kill a member of my tribe. And it goes on and on. So you want to be able to break out of that. And the way you break out of that is establish a system that is devoted to providing justice such that people trust it and they can relax with respect to meticulously punishing any wrongdoing that's done to my tribe. So that's what law codes are trying to accomplish, and I think that this is no exception to that. It's trying to establish a system of justice that people trust such that they don't take it into their own tribal hands. But in this, it's making a distinction between intentional murder and accidental murder. The vengeance system didn't make that distinction. And interestingly, the Code of Hammurabi didn't make that distinction. If I kill someone else, it doesn't matter whether I meant to or not. Under the Code of Hammurabi, I get the death penalty. So this is an amendment being made to the commonly shared law code of the ancient world. Verse 15, and he who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. So here it's physical abuse towards a parent. In the Code of Hammurabi, it is only the only thing that's mentioned is injury done to the father. It doesn't mention the mother at all. So it's not clear what would have happened there. And in that case, the child that does injury to a parent has his hand cut off. The next one, 16. And he who kidnaps a man, whether he sells him or he is found in possession, shall surely be put to death. And he... Oh, I'll stop there. So kidnapping was usually done for money, either to make him a slave or to sell them to someone else. The Code of Hammurabi treats this as an economic crime, and the penalties then are different depending on the social status of the one who is kidnapped. The higher the status, the greater the penalty. And it is monetary compensation for the penalty. Interestingly, here in Exodus, it's seen as a violation of the victim's personhood. It's not just an economic crime, and because their freedom has been taken away, then the death penalty is what is instituted. Verse 17, then, it seems like should go with 15, because it's a continuation of that same issue of someone abusing a parent. It says, and he who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. Now here, before it was physical abuse, now this is verbal abuse. And a couple of commentators point out, this isn't just incidental verbal abuse. This is something really serious, a renunciation of one's parent, more likely than just minor verbal abuse. The punishment for that is the same as for physical abuse. It's the death penalty. The next one, verse 18. And if men have a quarrel and one strikes the other with a stone or his fist and he does not die but remains in bed, if he gets up and walks around outside on his staff, then he who struck him shall go unpunished. He shall only pay for his loss of time and shall take care of him until he is completely healed. So here it's personal injury. We have a fight that breaks out. One man injures another either with his fist or with a stone. And the question is this a stone weapon or is this just a stone? It could be a stone weapon. In that case, it's probably this law goes way back in all likelihood. In any case, if there is an injury, a significant injury, then the question is it a fatal injury or not? If it's not a fatal injury, that is to say, he gets up after a couple days. Is it after a couple days? He gets up. Then the one who inflicted the injury just has to pay for his time and his care, or provide his care. But if he gets killed, then it doesn't say what happens if he dies, but presumably then it would fall under what was talked about early. He would be put to death because he killed that man. Okay. Verse 20, and if a man strikes a male or female slave with a rod and he dies at his hand, he shall be punished. If, however, he survives a day or two, no vengeance shall be taken, for he is his property. Typically, slaves were punished by hitting them with a rod because it was believed that that would not be a fatal blow. So the masters would sometimes punish their slaves with a rod, and if it only takes them a day or two to recover, then there is no penalty. It says, for he is his property. The slave is his property. And we'll come back to that. Verse 22. And if men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child so that she has a miscarriage. You know, this is going to get too lengthy, I think. Maybe I'll stop there and I will take up at verse 22 next time. Because I'll just point out, this is an interesting scenario. It's if two men have a fight, and one of the wives of one of the women, of the people fighting, comes to help or to break it up or whatever she's doing, and she gets hurt, and she's pregnant, and she gets hurt, then what do you do? A kind of sophisticated scenario. And yet, this scenario shows up in lots of the law codes throughout the ancient world, the same scenario. But they give different prescriptions as to what should be done. So I want to take a little bit of time to compare what various options were given in the ancient world to this particular scenario. So I will stop there and open it up for questions, and then I'll pick up here next time.
Thank you, David.
Mm-hmm.
In what sense should we take the word man throughout this passage? Sometimes it's clear that it's just a male human being, and sometimes it could be taken to represent either sex. Well, mm-hmm. How would you take the word man throughout this? In other words...
Sometimes I would take it to mean specifically a man, and sometimes more generally.
Okay. Can you give us a little...
One of the curious things about the law is that it seems to be addressed to men specifically. It really has men in mind. Now, I don't know if that's just a literary convention, but the imperatives that are used are male singular imperatives consistently. And it often refers to just a man, the man. It uses the term man in a situation. But sometimes it's clear that's got to apply to everybody. Other times it's more specific. And so I think you just have to go by the context. But I think it is significant and important to keep it in mind that it seems to be addressed to men. You see in Deuteronomy then that what God says is men, the head of the household is supposed to teach the family the law. So the law seems to be addressed to the men, and it is their responsibility then to pass that on to everybody in their household. And I think they would extrapolate, this is being said to the head of the household, but that has implications for all of us in the household.
Thank you. I'm still not clear when or what type of context would guide you in one direction as opposed to the other. He who kidnaps a man, whether he sells him or he's found in his possession, shall surely be put to death. Would you take that instance of man to represent either sex?
I would assume yes. But that's one of those situations that I was talking about last week, that when you're trying to put together that world view, you have to take all the clues and figure out, would a gender distinction here be significant or would it not be significant? If we're looking at the other cultures of the ancient world, it probably would have been significant. There probably would have been a different penalty for kidnapping a man with respect to kidnapping a woman. But it seems to me there are enough clues even within this code to steer one in the direction that there should not be that kind of distinction. You see elsewhere in this code where that distinction doesn't matter, but in the surrounding cultures it did.
Thank you.
The quote by Sarma about the law being enforced by personal conscience rather than the act of the government, who's doing the enforcement here? Who puts these people to death? Who makes them pay the debt? Who, you know what I'm saying?
Right. In Sarna's quote, he was dividing up these laws into two parts. The first part, there is the state takes action. And using what we know about, but the, in the other, and that's where it talks about the person's conscience. It's in those others where there's no penalty listed. That's where it's up to the person's conscience. But if the Israelites did the same thing as the surrounding cultures, they would have had judges and they would have had trials. And those judges would have determined what the punishment should be. And then that... It's not exactly clear who would be responsible for carrying out that punishment, and it may have varied a little bit depending on the crime.
Because later on, for certain things, don't they say the congregation shall take this person outside the city limits or whatever?
Typically, that's for stoning, right?
And that I've seen. I mean, it's not the Monty Python thing where everybody throws rocks at him. It's actually someone takes a big hurricane rock and crushes their skull,
right?
So someone's got to do that.
Right. There are places where the prescribed punishment, the prescribed form of execution is by stoning. Something that I did not know before is that the rabbis have different forms of execution for different crimes. So some are beheading, some are stoning. I can't remember, there are a couple of others that are used. I don't know how old that tradition is. I don't know where it came from. I don't know if that's worth taking into consideration or not. But presumably that would have been determined by the judge at the time of the trial.
It's kind of cool because it gives the judge, maybe in a rather difficult to decide case, or you're like, are we doing the right thing here? You could assign the person that, if it's not true, you could assign that false accuser the responsibility of carrying out the execution. If they can't do it, it's kind of like you want to take back your accusation. It gives them, it calls for wise people.
Exactly.
Thoughtful people. When you don't have a comprehensive, detailed code.
Right.
And that seems like...
I'm glad you brought that up because I think that's an important part. We need to recognize that what's happened in our legal system is we've tried to set up a system that requires as little wisdom on the part of the judge as possible. So you go through and you figure out what are all the offenses, and then you figure out what will be the penalty for each one. And so it can be, the law can be rather mechanically applied such that it's impartial in that anyone in that same situation would get the same penalty. Okay. So it has that advantage of a kind of impartiality. It has the disadvantage of not being able to fully take into account the circumstances of this particular incident. All of the circumstances. The system that Israel used, and presumably the surrounding cultures, it depended more on the wisdom of the judge to assess all of the factors and decide what would be the appropriate action, judgment, in this particular set of circumstances. And they have quite a bit of freedom to within which to make that determination. So it requires wise judges rather than our system leans in the direction of faithful bureaucrats. Just someone who is, yeah, like they do what they're told to do.
Mm-hmm. Do we wait 2 weeks for the answers to the question of why slavery first and slaves as property, or?
Let me see how quickly I can go through this. Yeah, let me take about 7 minutes and see if I can go through this. Why would this section on slavery be at the very beginning of this law code? I found an interesting comment by Raymond Westbrook, who is one of the main authorities on ancient Near Eastern law. And he wrote a little book on law in ancient Israel. And in this book, he just makes kind of an offhand comment that one of the curious things about the laws in ancient Israel is it provides for slavery, but there is this really difficult tension within the law itself. That is to say that in some respects, a slave is fully a person just as much as the master is. But in other respects, the slave is property to be done with as the master wants to do with it. And what Westbrook argues is God put that tension in there to be worked out. And in the long run, there was only one way that that could be worked out, and that was to do away with slavery. That the demise of slavery was built into the laws that God gave to Israel. This, just a couple weeks ago, a rabbi, Jonathan Sacks, who's the head rabbi in England, he wrote a little essay on this particular passage, and he was trying to answer the question, why didn't God just do away with slavery at this time? He's given him a law. Why didn't he just do away with slavery? I'll read. It's a few paragraphs here, but I think it's worth it. There are 613 commandments in the Torah. Why does Mishpatim, the first law code, begin where it does? The answer is equally obvious. The Israelites have just endured slavery in Egypt. There must be a reason why this happened, for God knew it was going to happen. Evidently, he intended it to happen. Centuries before, he had already told Abraham it would happen. As the sun was setting, Abram fell into a deep sleep, and a thick and dreadful darkness came over him. Then the Lord said to him, "Know for certain that for 400 years your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and that they will be enslaved and mistreated there." It seems that this was the necessary first experience of the Israelites as a nation. From the very start of the human story, the God of freedom sought the free worship of free human beings. But one after the other, people abused that freedom. First Adam and Eve, then Cain, then the generation of the flood, then the builders of Babel. God began again, this time not with all humanity, but with one man, one woman, one family who would become pioneers of freedom. But freedom is difficult. We each seek it for ourselves, but we deny it to others when their freedom conflicts with ours. So deeply is this true that within three generations of Abraham's children, Joseph's brothers were willing to sell him into slavery. A tragedy that did not end until Judah was prepared to forfeit his own freedom that his brother Benjamin could go free. It took the collective experience of the Israelites their deep, intimate, personal, backbreaking, bitter experience of slavery, a memory they were commanded never to forget, to turn them into a people who would no longer turn their brothers and sisters into slaves, a people capable of constructing a free society, the hardest of all achievements in the human realm. So it is no surprise that the first laws they were commanded after Sinai related to slavery. But then he asks the question, why didn't God just end slavery at this time? Skipping down in his essay, he says, if God does not want slavery, if he regards it as an affront to the human condition, why did he not abolish it immediately? Why did he allow it to continue, albeit in a restricted and regulated way? It is conceivable that God, who can produce water from a rock, manna from heaven, and turn sea into dry land, is it conceivable that such a God cannot change human behavior? Are there areas where the all-powerful is, so to speak, powerless? In 2008, economist Richard Thaler and law professor Cass Sustein published a fascinating book called Nudge. In it, they address a fundamental problem in the logic of freedom. On the one hand, freedom depends on not over-legislating. It means creating space within which people have the right to choose for themselves. And then there's another paragraph that I'll skip. It says, that is exactly what God does in the case of slavery. He does not abolish it, but he so circumscribes it that he sets in motion a process that will foreseeably, even if only after many centuries, lead people to abandon it of their own accord. I thought that was very insightful. And it's helpful to me because I used to have this impression that God gave the law and what he gave should have described the perfect society. Everything just the way it should be. And yet that doesn't seem to be what God did. But rather he gave something that was not completely different from what they were surrounded by all the time, but it is tweaked in some significant ways that sends it in a different direction that will only be fully developed centuries later. And it's got built-in contradictions that when those are worked out, that the things that were wrong with the surrounding cultures are completely done away with. And I find that fascinating. Okay, I'll let you go.